Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In June 2013, Edward Snowden's revelations that the U.S. government was spying on hundreds of millions of people around the world by collecting phone calls and emails outraged citizens about the further erosion of their civil liberties and constitutional rights. Today's guest, journalist Mark Hertzgard, argues that if you want to know why Snowden did what he did, you need to know the stories of two other men. Former NSA official Thomas Drake blew the whistle on the same surveillance 10 years before Edward Snowden did, but Thomas Drake went through official channels and got crushed. The other man is John Crane, a former Pentagon official who publicly identifies himself for the very first time in Mark Hertzgard's new book, Bravehearts. And he says his supervisors broke the law to silence whistleblowers' testimonies and ruin their lives. Because of this, Edward Snowden drew the logical conclusion he had to go outside of the system. So in this current environment in which whistleblowers face harsh and long jail sentences, what does it mean to be a whistleblower? Mark Hertzgard is the environment correspondent with The Nation magazine and the author of several books, including his most recent, Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. And Mark joins me in studio. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Always good to be at KALW.
It's always great to have you. So it's been 3 years since Edward Snowden came out with his explosive leak. Just remind us, what did Edward Snowden leak back then?
He brought forward some of the most classified information inside the United States government, and he brought the actual documents to the reporters Laura Poitras, the documentarian, Glenn Greenwald, and Ewan McCaskill at the Guardian newspaper. And essentially, he provided chapter and verse showing that the U.S. government was systematically collecting emails, phone calls, your transactions on websites, pretty much of anybody on earth who's connected to the internet, and crucially, doing this in secret and without court warrants. And so raising clear questions about the Fourth Amendment protections that we have in this country against an unreasonable search and seizure. And so Snowden brought that out. He brought the documents with him to Hong Kong. He knew that he was breaking the law in releasing these documents, which is why he left the country before he did it. And Poitras and Greenwald and McCaskill met him in Hong Kong for 3 days. They debriefed him. And they started breaking the story on, I think it was June 6 of 2013. And then on June 8 or 9, actually, they said to the world, and here's the guy who's told us all this. And it was Edward Snowden. They released a 14-minute video on the Guardian website. And it was shocking to so many people, including the reporters, who all thought that this guy, because he's got access to such very, very high-level stuff, he must be some senior, like, you know, gray-haired guy who's been inside the bureaucracy all of his life. It turned out he was a 29-year-old contract employee, which means he wasn't even a full employee of the NSA. He was working for Booz and Allen, a private company for the NSA, 29 years old, and he brought himself forward and explained who he was and why he had done it. And that was a critical part of it, that he was able to define himself to some extent in the eyes of the world, rather than so many people who run afoul of the law. We as the public, the first image we have of them is them being led away in handcuffs, which inevitably, if only subliminally, creates an impression about who that person is. And the person that we saw with Edward Snowden was this young man who clearly had thought a lot about this. You may agree with him or not agree with him, but this was not something he did lightly, and he explained, you know, Fourth Amendment, and I think that people should know about this. You may agree with it, and the government says that you need this kind of surveillance to protect us against terrorism, but Americans in particular have a right to know that their government is spying on them.
And because Edward Snowden was a contractor, he did not receive the same whistleblower protections that government employees are supposed to receive, right?
Well, that's true, but he also, because he worked in the national security field, his whistleblower protections were also considerably curtailed. And then on top of that, it doesn't really matter, as we know from the story of Thomas Drake, who was definitely was working for the NSA. He was a very high-level guy, but he went through channels, and he ended up getting destroyed.
And we'll talk about Thomas Drake in detail, but first off, is the government still collecting all of this information today? And how do we know if they are?
Oh, there's no question that it's being collected, but there has been, and this is one of the things that Snowden's revelations changed. Last year, in 2015, the USA Patriot Act, which of course was the big legislation passed after September 11th, that was used to justify this surveillance, that came up for reauthorization on Capitol Hill, and astonishingly, to someone like me who's been covering that issue for a long time, I never thought that, the Patriot Act would be voted down, because it never was. But in 2015, this strange bedfellows alliance between Tea Party Republicans on Capitol Hill and sort of Bernie Sanders Democrats came together, and they blocked reauthorization of the Patriot Act. That's a big deal. Until it was amended, and the two amendments get to your question, Rose, which is it still being collected? Yes. But it has always been collected by the telecommunications companies, the Verizons, the AT&Ts of the world. And previously, the NSA basically had a close relationship with them, and it just automatically, the telecom companies just gave it to the NSA. That's no longer the case. That's one of the two critical reforms that were passed with the reauthorization. Now, they are still collecting it, the telecom companies, but in order for the government to get it, they have to apply for a warrant, and the warrant has to be specific and say, we want this. Now, that's good. But don't get carried away, because the history shows that generally, 99.9% of the requests for warrants are given. So if the government wants it, it can still go get it. So any of you who are out there and wondering, is your stuff being collected? It is definitely being collected. And you need to think about that. Snowden has written very explicitly that people who, like us, like journalists or lawyers, or if you're a financial advisor or anyone handling sensitive information, you need to know that it is being collected and the government can get it. And not just today, by the way. They can do it 10 years from now if they decide that they want to go after you. That is what really animated Edward Snowden's fears about this. He says, this is Big Brother. And we have a right to at least debate it, which means we have to know about it.
He also talked about the fact that they could go back in your history 5-10 years and make very strange connections that don't make any sense to you as a person who conducts business, is a journalist, whatever, but does to them.
Right.
And they can charge you based on false information that they think is actually accurate, based on connecting dots.
This is the concept of metadata.
Okay, thank you.
That's what they call metadata, and that's what President Obama said, by the way, right after Snowden's leak. He said, listen, America, we are not listening to your phone calls, which was narrowly true, but the president was being very disingenuous there. He was really talking like a lawyer, because no, they're not listening to your phone calls unless they want to, right, unless they decide to, in which case they can. But they don't, and what Snowden would say is, they don't need to listen to your phone calls in order to understand what you're doing. And he said, look, I did this at the NSA. If I know, and this isn't the example he used, but somebody else used it, and I think it's valid. If you know that person X, young woman, 24 years old, and you see that oftentimes after 11 p.m., there's phone calls to this other telephone number, and you check that other number, and it's a young man who's 28 years old, and there's a lot of those phone calls. And then you see that on Thursday a week ago, she went to a gynecologist's office, and then there's all these phone calls after that, and then she goes to visit her priest and talks to her parents. Well, you can kind of put together what might be happening in that person's life. You don't have to listen to the phone calls to understand she's probably gotten pregnant and is trying to figure out what to do about it, right? That's the kind of example that they can also use in any other sphere of your life. And doesn't matter if you're not breaking the law today. 10 years from now, let's say that you decide to get involved in a local political fight, or you run for office, or whatever it may be, they can come back, as Snowden says, and basically decide to say anything they want on the basis of that data.
Mark Hertzgaard is author of the new book, Brave Hearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. You argue, Mark, that if we want to know why Edward Snowden did what he did, we need to know the stories of two other men. Mm. Let's first talk about former NSA official Thomas Drake, who blew the whistle on the same surveillance 10 years before Snowden did, but he went through official channels and he got crushed. Tell us a little bit about Thomas Drake.
Tom Drake is about as straight arrow of a guy as you could find. He was working and reporting directly to the number three official at NSA. Now, NSA is the biggest, most lavishly funded spy agency in history. Traditionally, it was supposed to only spy outside of the United States. And it does electronic spying, basically, whereas the CIA still use, you know, agents and human assets. NSA is up in the sky with satellites and basically listening in that way. And Drake started work there on September 11th, 2001, ironically enough. And then after the attacks that day, he was tasked with basically putting together the NSA's postmortem report on the 9/11 terrorist attacks, because everybody, the media, the public, Congress was like, how did this happen? How did you guys miss this? We've been spending God knows how much money and you missed it. So he went through the records, and with the top security clearances, he could see everything, and he discovered two amazing things. One was that the NSA was beginning to do all this mass surveillance without telling anybody, but two, that they had missed 9/11. They had had they had picked up phone calls from two of the so-called San Diego hijackers, who were Al-Qaeda agents working for bin Laden, who were living in San Diego before the attacks, and were calling back to the Al-Qaeda headquarters in Yemen. Now, NSA and CIA, everybody knows that Al-Qaeda's headquarters were in Yemen. That was the operational headquarters. And, you know, bin Laden would convey his orders there, and then they would convey the orders to America. NSA had seven phone calls from these guys going in there. And why did they miss it? They missed it, according to Drake, because they had created this, bureaucratic mentality of, we want to collect everything. And so they were collecting everything all over the world, phone calls. Well, that's such an enormous amount of data that you created. They said, ironically, this made America less secure, because how do you find the needle in these haystacks that are growing exponentially over time? And so they missed that. So Thomas Drake began to try and bring this information forward. And he talked to his superiors at NSA, got nowhere. He eventually talked to the congressional oversight committees on Capitol Hill. They didn't want to hear about it. And so he eventually talked to a reporter without divulging classified information. And that was kind of what led to his destruction. And what happened specifically is that Thomas Drake had his house raided by FBI agents, and he was eventually arrested, charged under the Espionage Act with 35 years in jail, which when you're 55 years old is essentially life in jail. They suspended his security clearance, put him on trial, ruined his finances. They blackballed him inside of the security field. And stripped him of his pension. And so today, Thomas Drake is working at the Genius Bar as basically a floor clerk at an Apple store in suburban Washington, D.C. That is what happens when you go through channels.
To spend a little more time on what he revealed about 9/11, because so much is done in the name of 9/11, in your book, Thomas Drake told you in July 2015 that Michael Hayden, the only person to have directed both the NSA and the CIA, former four-star Air Force general who served under both Democrats and Republicans, Thomas Drake told you, quote, Hayden has been the main espouser of the big lie that we could have stopped 9/11 if we'd had the mass surveillance that he put in place after the attacks. That is a lie, and Hayden knows it's a lie, end quote. You also interviewed Thomas Hayden.
Michael Hayden.
Michael Hayden, yeah. Thank you. So how did Michael Hayden, respond to Thomas Drake's accusations based on what he saw at the NSA?
Right. I was, frankly, very surprised that Michael Hayden spoke to me so much. We did three interviews, and he kept coming back, and I'm not quite sure why, but he does care a lot about his media image, Michael Hayden does. And he basically just ridiculed Thomas Drake as kind of crazy and wrong, and said that, you know, we don't do that. Yes, we missed some hints, but we did the San Diego stuff. That's nonsense. He essentially denied it. Yet the fact is that that stuff was in the database. Those seven calls were in the database, and Hayden tried to put forward a bunch of technological gobbledygook about why that couldn't have happened, because we only collect the downlink and not the uplink, or was it the uplink and not the downlink, and went back and forth. And so I went around and I asked other technical experts, does this make sense? Is this possible? And essentially nobody that I interviewed, except for Michael Hayden, thought that that was technologically possible. However, it's interesting. Michael Hayden did not approve of the way that Drake was crushed. And that happened under Obama, by the way. I mean, it began, let me be clear, they began going after Drake under Bush Cheney. But the prosecution of Drake continued under Obama. And Hayden said, look, they overdid it with Drake. They should not have destroyed that man.
Dick Cheney was also directly involved in destroying Thomas Drake.
Yes, he was.
You reveal that Thomas Drake brought his concerns about wasteful spending at the NSA and the surveillance program to a Baltimore Sun reporter. Why did he choose the Baltimore Sun?
Probably not the best choice, but the reason is that the NSA is located in Fort Meade, Maryland, which is halfway between Washington and Baltimore, and so a lot of people who work at the NSA read the Baltimore Sun. The problem was that the Baltimore Sun is not, I'm sorry to say, as a former Baltimore resident, it's not taken seriously inside the Beltway, and so when those stories came out, nobody paid attention to it inside of the major media, but the White House saw it, and that's when they began to say, this guy's got to go.
And what was Dick Cheney's role in that?
Well, Dick Cheney, of course, was the Darth Vader inside of the Bush White House, and he was really the president for those 8 years, much more than George Bush was. And he was the one who drove the Patriot Act and everything that came from it, including the mass surveillance. And so when that cat began to get out of the bag, which wasn't, by the way, with the Baltimore Sun stories. It was with the New York Times stories in December of 2005. That's really what triggered it. The New York Times published a story that, you know, it's in retrospect, Snowden's revelations dwarfed it. But still, it was the very first information that the public had that that the Bush-Cheney administration was listening to a lot more phone calls and emails than it should have been. And by all accounts, Cheney was apoplectic and said, put out the message through the government bureaucracy, find this leaker. And that is what then brings in John Crane and Tom Drake, because the guys inside the Pentagon, the inspector general and the general counsel there said, how can we help Cheney find these guys? Well, we had to, remember that guy? He was part of that whistleblower complaint we saw about this same stuff. Probably he's one of the leakers. And so their first felony, they gave up the name of Thomas Drake to the Justice Department. Well, that is a cardinal sin. That is a direct breaking of the law. The basis, the cornerstone of whistleblower rules and protections is that you don't divulge the name of the whistleblower. For obvious reasons, anybody who has a boss, if you're complaining about the boss to the boss's boss, you know, you don't want your name used if you want to keep your job. And so they outed him. The Pentagon Inspector General's office outed him. And just to give listeners a sense of just how outrageous that is, the Inspector General, in case people don't know, that every federal agency has one. And they're essentially the sheriff. They're the internal sheriff. They're supposed to make sure that that agency obeys the law and its employees obey the law. And it can be everything from, are you cheating on your time card? Is there sexual harassment going on? All the way up to, are you spending those hundreds of millions of dollars that Congress appropriated? Are you spending them properly? Or are you, you know, wasting them? So the Inspector General is the sheriff. And the sheriff was the one who was breaking the law, was giving up Tom Drake's name and other whistleblowers to the Department of Justice, which before long led all of them to have at dawn their houses bump, 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 FBI agents with guns saying, "We need to talk to you, Mr. Drake." And that was the beginning of his nightmare.
Mm. We're going to take a call before we go to break. It's a related question about what happens at the very top. Let's hear from Kurt in Monterey. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Greetings to your guest. You know, David Talbot was on your show not too long ago, and he basically came out and said that Alan Dulles, you know, one of the founders of the CIA, was basically a psychopath. Did your guest, has he encountered this, that some of the critics who are the toughest on Snowden and Drake underestimate the disconnect from honesty and ethics that happens in some of these large governmental organizations? I mean, how do we expect these people to fight leadership that has no connection or no interest in honesty?
I'm glad to hear David Talbot's name. He's the editor on this book, Brave Hearts. He's the one who convinced me and gave me the assignment to write it. But I hesitate to use words like psychopath and all of that about government officials. But if you want to talk about honesty and morality, I think that most of them see those kinds of issues inside of Washington as luxuries that cannot be afforded. They believe, especially in the national security sphere, you know, there's bad guys out there. We have to, as Dick Cheney famously said, we have to work in the shadows. So they have very well-developed internal rationalization mechanisms for why they do what they do. That said, Michael Hayden's a very interesting case because he is a proudly and outspoken about his – he's serious about his Catholic faith. He more than once in our interviews for this book talked about how he goes to Mass and feels like he's doing the right thing. And the public needs to – you know, you all complain about us listening in on your phone calls, but you also don't want another 9/11. And, you know, we're the ones who have to make the tough calls. That his talking about Catholicism, though, provoked Ray McGovern, who's a longtime veteran former CIA agent who now has had second thoughts about all of that stuff. McGovern told me in an interview for this book, he said, "Yeah, you know, I know that Hayden had 18 years of Catholic school education. I only had 17, so I must have missed that class about how waterboarding is consistent with the Catholic Church's teachings."
Mark Hertzgard is the author of Brave Hearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. We have just a minute before break, and we're going to talk about John Crane after the break. But first, there's one more man that we should learn more about related to Thomas Drake, and that is William Binney. He spent 36 years at the NSA breaking codes and designing surveillance operations before he retired in 2002.
Bill Binney is a great public servant, and he is, along with Drake, in the book I describe them as the NSA 4 plus 1 whistleblowers. Drake was the plus 1, but the NSA 4 were Binney and two others, and then a staffer on Capitol Hill. And they came forward with Drake to make these accusations. And Binney is, you know, he's arguably the greatest mathematical mind that has ever worked inside the United States government. And by the way, not shy about... he feels like the NSA historically did the right thing, that there was a Cold War, that we needed to fight Soviet communism, et cetera, et cetera. He was proud of that. However, when he saw what the Bush-Cheney administration was doing with surveillance, he could not stomach it. He saw that his own work was being perverted and turned against the American people, and he's a very serious and proud conservative in the traditional sense of the term who believes in liberty and who has now publicly apologized for how his former bosses used that stuff to spy on everybody. And he said to one public meeting, "I'm sorry, I did not intend that." He resigned in October of 2001, and he too has become a whistleblower. Very key source for me in this book, and you know, an example of how I think many people on the left think that anybody who is working inside the government, they have to have no morality. Bill Binney has definite morality, may not be your morality, but he's somebody who was a public servant for a long time, and he stepped forward and told the truth about this stuff, even though, you know, like Thomas Drake, he faced enormous pushback.
Aren't most of these NSA whistleblowers Republicans or conservatives?
That's one of the striking things, Rose. Virtually all of them are conservatives. And they are saying things, as I say in the book, they're talking about, this is a police state that is taking shape here. This is like Nazi Germany. We have to be careful. It doesn't matter whether you haven't done anything. That's crazy talk. They can use this to go after their political enemies. And what was striking to me is that they are all conservatives, and they are well-educated, and they care about words. They don't say things like Nazi Germany and police state lightly. And unfortunately, the mainstream media in Washington, D.C. still tends to take the government position on this stuff by default almost and not look at how these brave public servants are coming forward and warning us we need to stop this before it becomes unstoppable.
Mark Hertzgard is the author of Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. Mark argues that if you want to know why Edward Snowden did what he did, you need to know the stories of two other men. We talked about Thomas Drake, and after the break, we will talk about John Crane, a former Pentagon official who publicly identifies himself for the first time in Mark's new book. He says his supervisors broke the law to silence whistleblowers' testimonies and ruin their lives. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW. Please join me Wednesday at 5 p.m. for the next Manager's Report to the Listeners. I'll be giving you my perspective on local public radio as we approach our 75th birthday. On September 1st, 1941, KALW went on the air as San Francisco's original FM station and the first FM in the West. After 75 years, we have built one of the most productive and creative stations in public radio, and we've kept it community-based and listener-supported. As always, I want to hear what you have to say. I'll take your calls and emails about the past, present, and future of KALW. Tune in and take part. It's the Manager's Report, Wednesday at 5 p.m. here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's show with Mark Hertzgard, author of the new book, Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden, we'd love to hear from you. 866. This is a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. Join us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Revelations about the current state of whistleblowing. As Mark just said, most of the NSA whistleblowers are conservatives, but we don't hear that much about their full lives in the media on a regular basis. And Mark decided to write a book to connect all the dots. And also, for the very first time, John Crane, a former Pentagon official, speaks publicly. He says his supervisor broke the law to silence testimony and ruin the lives of whistleblowers. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. So, Mark, let's talk about John Crane. He hasn't spoken before. How did you get him to do an interview? When did you first learn about John Crane?
I've done a lot of whistleblowing reporting over the years, and I've gotten to know the people at the Government Accountability Project, which is, I think, clearly the premier whistleblower advocacy organization in the world, really. They're in Washington, D.C. And by the way, anyone out there, if you're thinking about becoming a whistleblower, don't call me. You need to call the Government Accountability Project in Washington, GAP. And they are an NGO, and they have counseled literally thousands of whistleblowers from both the government and the corporate worlds over 38 years. And they represented Snowden, Thomas Drake, and John Crane. And I've done stories with them in the past about BP oil spill for Newsweek and the crazy way that we can get guns and bombs onto planes. That was for Vanity Fair. So Government Accountability Project, they were my first call when I did this book. And I said, what do you got? You know, and they said, well, you know, this we're representing Snowden now, and we're representing this guy Tom Drake, but there's somebody else you might want to talk to. And they put me together with this guy who, at that point, I was still calling him the third man. And he is in the book still described as the third man because I needed to protect his identity until the book actually was published. And he was the third man because, as you say, you know, I say, if you want to know why Snowden did it the way he did it, you need to know the stories of two other men. And one is Drake, and this one is the third man. And I must say, a little shout out to Graham Greene here. Everybody knows the Orson Welles movie, The Third Man, but it was a Graham Greene novel that was The Third Man. And that's John Crane. And John Crane ran the whistleblower protection unit inside the Pentagon. And again, he's a perfect example of somebody who's, I don't know, but I suspect he's probably a Republican, pretty conservative guy.
A very high-ranking Department of Defense official.
Oh, he was the Assistant Inspector General. That's very high up. And, you know, 25 years in the service. He comes out of a military family. But he believed in straight shooting. He believed that you apply the law. And he also believed in the importance of principled dissent, that we need whistleblowers to be able to come forward. And by the way, they are legally obligated as a federal employee. You have an affirmative obligation to, if you see, quote unquote, waste, fraud, or abuse, unquote, you have an affirmative obligation as a federal employee to bring that forward. And we as taxpayers want that to happen. You know, we want to know if agency, the Department of Agriculture, is spending its crop subsidy money wrong or what have you. And this is also true, by the way, in the corporate sector. Corporations tend to, and bureaucracies in general, tend to have an aggressive attacking approach to whistleblowers when, in fact, it's in their long-term interest to know. You want to know the problem before it destroys your company. So that was how John Crane looked at it. And he did not take a position pro or con on what Thomas Drake and the surveillance stuff. That was not the point. But he felt like they needed to have the right to bring that forward and not suffer from it. And, of course, that's not what happened. But that's the story that I tell in the book. He, John Crane, was fighting at the highest levels of the Pentagon to get fair treatment. And what he tells in Bravehearts for the first time is how his superiors, again, the Inspector General and the General Counsel, the cop and the lawyer for the Pentagon, repeatedly, not once, not by accident, repeatedly broke the law in dealing with Drake. They outed Drake. They gave up his name. We've talked about that. Second, after Drake began to fight back and there was a legal case and to defend himself, then the Inspector General and General Counsel destroyed evidence in that case. And then, not content with two felonies, they decided that they had to lie to the federal judge in that case about having to destroy the evidence. Now, believe me, Rose, if you or I did any of those things, we would be looking at the inside of a jail cell. But that's not what happened with these guys. However, it still might. And that is one thing that I want to point out here, that because John Crane's allegations have now come forward, and not only in this book, Bravehearts, but he's gone through, and it's interesting, he's gone through the official process. For reasons I don't entirely understand, John Crane still believes in the system, or at least he wants to give the system a chance to work. And it's interesting, his allegations have now been affirmed by the Federal Office of Special Counsel, which is an agency nobody knows about inside the federal government, but it adjudicates whistleblower disputes throughout the government. And they found that he was substantially correct. And that's critical because that then legally obligated the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Ashton Carter. He now has to initiate a new investigation of Crane's allegations against the former Inspector General and still the General Counsel there. And the Justice Department is now investigating those people. So, you know, those people could end up going to jail for this. That's one of the things that I think everybody needs to understand about whistleblowers. When whistleblowers come forward with the information that powerful interests want to keep secret, when they bring that forward, big changes can happen. Wars can be ended, or at least questioned, and deadly products can be taken off the market, and liberty can be defended in the case of Snowden. And we need to understand the vital role that whistleblowers play in our democracy, and also understand that for the most part, they end up destroyed. They do not end up like Edward Snowden, a hero around the world, still active and pushing for this. Most of them end up financially destroyed, often emotionally destroyed. Their family life is often ruined. And I think that's part of the reason that I wanted to write this book is to you know, at the very least, whistleblowers give up their lives to save our lives. And at the very least, we owe them an understanding of what they do and a respect for it. And that's what I've tried to provide.
You spoke with Tom Devine, Gap's legal director. He wrote a book called The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide.
Yeah.
And he writes, "For those who think that blowing the whistle is glamorous or a path to recognition, think again. The majority of whistleblowers suffer in obscurity, frustrated by burned career bridges and vindication they were never able to obtain. The prominent, lionized beacons of hope are rare exceptions, and even most of them pay a horrible price with life long scars."
That is unfortunately true in my experience. However, there are some interesting changes now under the Obama administration. The enigma of Barack Obama, you know, it transcends many issues, and we see it on whistleblowing. The people at the Government Accountability Project say Obama has been without question the best president on corporate whistleblowing and without question the worst president on national security whistleblowing. You know, they've put more journalists in jail. They've gone after whistleblowers more than any previous administration, including Bush Cheney. However, on the corporate side, there are now real reforms. And so you have 80 million private sector workers in this country who now have full whistleblower rights, and which means that you can bring forward information and you have a right to a jury trial. This is no longer something that can be hushed up. And on Wall Street, and I love this example, there is now basically a bounty program. If you're a whistleblower and you bring forward evidence of, you know, shenanigans, let's say, on the corporate financial side, and that your information and evidence leads to taxpayers basically, you know, winning extra money because we're shutting down these bad actors on Wall Street, you, the whistleblower, get, I think it's a 10% finder's fee. Mm. And so one of the lawyers who I interviewed said that he had a client who had walked away with $35 million because he saved the taxpayers $350 million by showing that, and I can't say the name of the financial institution, but that financial institution X was cheating on certain financial transactions that were not only, you know, screwing people in the marketplace, but were depriving the U.S. Treasury of tax revenues that were rightfully ours. So now there are some incentives to step forward and do this. And that's important to know. It's not entirely hopeless, but any of you out there listening to this who are thinking of becoming a whistleblower, definitely you want to contact the Government Accountability Project because they can talk you through it. And they're quite candid. Sometimes it's not the best choice for you to do.
In that particular case, which you write about in your book, is this information public, but in this case the bank redacted?
Is what information public?
That
they broke the law?
The person who got the $35 million for saving taxpayers, $300 million from this unnamed bank, is that information
public? It's public information, but it is not widely known information. That was one of the reasons that the lawyer said, look, I really want you to put this in your book because everybody thinks that being a whistleblower is a path to ruin, and I want people to know that it doesn't have to be in the corporate world, and we need to get these stories out. But as you can imagine, you know, the banks are not keen to have that information out. And I've tried to offer that story to various editors of mine who work in business publications, and I've never gotten a call back on that.
Huh. Well, it seems like the public needs to know that this is happening in order for more people to step forward and for the public to believe that, okay, maybe this does actually work. Because right now, a lot of people believe it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, and they have good reason to believe
that. Right. I'm speaking today with journalist Mark Hertzgard about his new book, Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. And he argues that if you want to know why Edward Snowden did what he did, you need to know the stories of two men. Former NSA official Thomas Drake blew the whistle on the same surveillance 10 years before Snowden did. Unlike Snowden, Drake went through official government channels. He got crushed. The other man is John Crane, a former high-level Pentagon official who identifies himself for the first time in Mark's book, Bravehearts. He says supervisors broke the law, silenced whistleblowers' testimony, ruined their lives. I want to talk specifically about what John Crane complained about. Can you again remind us of the NSA 4 plus 1? Who are these?
Sure. The NSA 4 plus 1, the 1 is Thomas Drake, and the 4 are Bill Binney and two other high-level NSA technicians, and then a fourth was a woman named Diane Rourke, who was the top staffer at the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. And they, the four of them, the reason I separate them 4+1 is that the four of them were already retired from government, and so they did not fear retaliation as much. Drake was still inside the NSA, and so he was willing to be part of their whistleblower complaint, but he didn't want his name used because he, too, suspected that he would be retaliated against. And they were breaking – they were complaining about the surveillance that was put in place by the Bush-Cheney people, and they complained on two levels. One, that there was corporate welfare going on, wasting money on a hugely expensive program when Bill Binney had designed a program that could achieve the same goals but be much, much cheaper and, oh, by the way, also protect Americans' civil liberties. You would not have just been scooping up all information willy-nilly. That argument, and
can we stick on that argument for a minute? Just because in this country we're often told that we're broke, we can't fix the water system in Flint.
Oh, God.
Sorry, schools, but teachers, you have to buy your kids your own school supplies. We just don't have the money, right? So to talk about this trailblazer, which these whistleblowers said was grotesquely overpriced.
Yeah.
The whistleblowers charged it was a $3.8 billion boondoggle.
Right. There were two programs, actually, they were angry about, Trailblazer and Stellar Wind. But Trailblazer was the real waste of money. And Trailblazer never became operational. $3.8 billion never became operational. And they had an alternative program called Thin Thread that Bill Binney designed that would have cost about $30 million. That's $0.3 billion. So we just were ripped off to the tune of $3.5 billion. And I want to just say this is one of the huge issues that is getting almost no attention in this election year, the whole idea that we don't have enough money. I remember last time I was here in this studio, guest hosting for you, actually, we had on Andrew Coburn, who I commend everyone. Andrew wrote a piece in Harper's that went through this and just showed this. There is so much money being wasted. You know, you can have all the arguments you want about policy and should the United States have military bases around the world. Separate from all that, there is just so much waste. The hogs have their snouts in the trough of the military-industrial complex. They have for decades. And again, these were serious, principled conservatives who were saying, no, this is not right. That we are giving, you know, $700 an hour fees to these Beltway bandits instead of investing in something that is cheaper, going to do the job, and, oh, by the way, protects your civil liberties at the same time.
William Benny, the 36-year NSA veteran, told you that these contractors made about $700,000 a year. Hmm. They were lobbying to get us out of there, Booz Allen, Boeing, all the corporations up and down the National Business Parkway. This is the highway near NSA headquarters in Fort Meade. Because if we used Thin Thread, he said, they wouldn't get their big paychecks.
Yeah, he said, it's all about money. Well, you know, God bless them for coming forward with that. And they did not prevail on that. And Michael Hayden, I should say, in full disclosure, he denied that that was what he had done. He admitted that the program didn't go anywhere, but he said that it was just, you know, it didn't scale. That was the problem. It didn't scale.
So what happened to this complaint about all of this waste?
Well, they went first to the inspector general at the NSA and got ruled against. And then they went up the ladder from the NSA to the Pentagon, NSA obviously being part of the Defense Department. And that was where John Crane enters the story, because John Crane was running the Whistleblower Protection Unit. So their complaint went to him. And unlike the NSA inspector general's office, his office substantially affirmed their complaint, not only on the money wasting, but also on the civil liberties angles that, you know, we're basically now collecting information on all these people, and that's a big constitutional problem if you believe in the Fourth Amendment. And so Crane's office substantially affirmed this. However, that was where things began to go south. For the whistleblowers. On the one hand, they did score a victory. They did stop Trailblazer on Capitol Hill. It was like the last straw, and their information. So the whistleblowers had an effect there. You know, Congress finally pulled the plug on Trailblazer. But by that time, the New York Times had published its story, and Cheney was on the warpath and wanted the heads of whoever had leaked that stuff to the Times. And once the information went to the Pentagon, you know, John Crane was running the unit, but John Crane reported to the general counsel and to the inspector general. He was only the assistant inspector general. He reported to the inspector general. And the two of those, his superiors, were the ones who allegedly outed Crane to the Justice Department and the others. You know, all of them had their houses raided. All of them were threatened with prosecution. All of them Diane Rourke was told, you need to give up Drake, you need to testify against him, or we're going to really make your life. And, you know, they put her through 6 years of hell. She didn't break, but she said it was very, very stressful.
Thomas Drake is working at an Apple store today. Where is John Crane?
John Crane is fighting his case through the system. He lives in suburban Washington in Virginia, and he has crossed a huge threshold because the Federal Office of Special Counsel basically said he's right, and that means that the Defense Department has to investigate anew, but of course they can't investigate themselves, so the Justice Department is now investigating these people. And astonishingly, this again I don't really understand about John, he wants his old job back, and he thinks he can get his old job back because he really believes in the system, you see. He wants the system to work, and so he thinks that basically he's going to get his nemeses out, and he'll be hired in. Personally, and this is Mark Hertzgard now, my own personal opinion, I find that a little hard to imagine. Bureaucracies do not forget, much less forgive. But we'll see. And John Crane, I'll just mention quickly, since I know we're getting to the top of the hour here, I think what drives John through all of this is his family background, which is an amazing story. He has a grandfather on his mother's side. His mother's German. And his grandfather stood up to Adolf Hitler at gunpoint and faced him down. Yeah. I don't know too many people who can make that claim. And his grandfather did this in 1923 at the famous first night Hitler tried to take over Germany in 1923, 10 years before he became chancellor. And he had the famous beer hall putsch in Munich. And he went in with 600 armed men to a public meeting where the governor was speaking and announced that the national revolution has begun. And he came through the crowd and up to the front, in front of the governor and the generals. And John Crane's grandfather, at that point, was a 40-year-old military officer. And he stood in front of Hitler to not let Hitler, you know, shoot his boss, basically. And Hitler pointed the gun at the second bodyguard, at his chest, and the... And Crane's grandfather said, you know, Mr. Hitler, in this way, you will never liberate Germany. And Hitler, who, you know, was just a kind of a hapless corporal, was intimidated and lowered the gun and walked away. And foreshadowing his great military strategy that he showed in World War II, he let these guys get away. And so they left the beer hall and they organized the counter coup that crushed Hitler's coup the next day. Point being, in John Crane's case, he spent his summers in Germany as a kid, and his mother and grandmother told him that story over and over, and the moral lesson was always the same. John, in life, one must always do the right thing, despite the risks. And that's why John Crane put his career on the line, to do the right thing, and why he still thinks that he should come back. God bless him.
Well, maybe we can get John on the show. It would be so interesting.
I'm sure he'd love to be.
We have a couple minutes left, Mark. Where do you see this going? What's in store for the future of whistleblowers and journalists who break these stories? I mean, it's also important to talk about journalists who don't have the protection of The Guardian or The New York Times, for example.
Like myself?
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, although I will say I'm very proud that we broke this scoop in The Guardian. And not the New York Times. I did an op-ed piece in The Times. Let's talk about whistleblowers. Look, whistleblowers always face an uphill struggle. It will never be easy to be a whistleblower because you are speaking out against your peers, against your colleagues, against your superiors, against the status quo. It takes a certain individual to do that. Most of us don't fight City Hall. We know that it's an uphill battle and we're probably going to lose and we've got kids and we've got a mortgage or whatever it is. We rationalize why we can't do that. Whistleblowers do not. They are... I think it's in their DNA or something. There is something in them. They cannot keep quiet. And not only can they not keep quiet when they know something's wrong, they continue with it even when they're being retaliated against. And kind of it almost makes them more determined. And it can make them crazy. Believe me, and I've experienced this with a number of the whistleblowers that I've interviewed, they are not easy people often. They are often paranoid. They become paranoid for good reason. They are full of themselves. They're megalomaniacal. They can be very self-righteous. And yet, at the end of the day, we need them. And so, you know, my last line in the book is, bless them, warts and all. They're going to need it. I do think, though, that one of the things that we as the public can do is to start by understanding them and respecting them and then pushing our elected officials to get serious about protecting them. We have pretty good laws on the books, not as good as they should be, but they need to be implemented better. And I'm sorry to say that Barack Obama has been very, very poor on that front, on the at least on the side of the government whistleblowers.
Just quickly, what would change under a Hillary Clinton administration?
I'm sorry to say it doesn't look like much would change. She has said to this point that Edward Snowden should come home and face the music, which implies, as she has said, and Barack Obama has said this too, look, Edward Snowden could have been a whistleblower. He could have gone through channels, and she said, I think he would have gotten a good reception, unquote. Well, Secretary Clinton, please tell that to Thomas Drake. He did exactly what you're advising, and his life was crushed. And I can give you the names of 10 other whistleblowers who've had the same experience. If you're going to be president, if you're going to be serious about this stuff, you need to understand that that is not how it works inside the government, unless you're maybe the Secretary of State, in which case they overlook how you have compromised classified information with your email server.
Mark Hertzgard, author of the new book, Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. Mark, thanks for the information. Thanks for coming in.
Always happy to be here.
Thank you. And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the complicated history of the national parks. Yellowstone was the first national park established in 1872. It was an era of Western expansion, Native American removal, and Jim Crow. Indigenous people once inhabited nearly every national park and monument throughout the country. What's the full and honest history of our national parks? How can we address the wrongs of the past and protect wild places for the future? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.